Hey, Chiquita.
Hey, Ian.
I'm going to play you a sound.
Why are you making creepy and laughing noises at me?
I'm going to play it again. I want you to guess what emotion this represents.
I feel creeped out.
That's close. That was meant to be halfway between amusement and elation.
And maybe I just got to get acquainted with this voice, but it definitely, that sounded like somebody like creeping up behind someone, you know, the person in the shadows.
Yeah. To me, it sounded a little bit nervous almost, like the kind of laughter you do when you've just put on a surprise party for someone and you've seen the reaction on their face and it's not quite as happy as you're expecting and you're worried that you might actually have annoyed them.
You're right. It is really, he'll agree with me, right?
I'm going to play some more now. I'll explain why in a bit.
That was Glenn Close's reaction to Billy Porter's tuxedo floor-length velvet gown.
They describe it as the mixture of surprise and awe. Which I guess is kind of what that is. I feel like you won that one.
Yahoo! Can there be a ding, ding, ding? Okay. This is a fun game. I like this.
Let's go for... Now, any children listening, or any parents with children, you might want to, I'm scared to go over this one, but we'll find out now how inappropriate it is, I guess. So, sorry in advance.
Aww.
Ooh, that wasn't what I expected at all.
Aww. That doesn't make sense in the context of the advisory that you just gave, because that sounds like someone seeing something kind of cute and being like, aww.
The label they've given it doesn't match what I thought it was going to be. It was labeled as a form of arousal, but...
Oh, that was not arousal. That was anti-arousal.
Yeah, I mean, it's arousal mixed with sympathy.
No, those things should not be mixed.
Yeah, that feels kind of like oil and water, doesn't it? And finally, don't know exactly how easy it's going to be to guess what it is, but... Mm.
That one sounded like it needs the parental advisory.
That is pain.
Stop. Terrible at this game. I think from now on you need to augment your speech with this cast of supporting characters. They can be your own personal Greek chorus. That way you can still be super British and like withhold all of your emotions, and then you can just outsource it to these automatons.
Yeah, that's enough of that. Let me explain this. This is a taxonomy of feelings. It comes from the Greater Good Research Center at the University of Berkeley in California. And it is a way of mapping 24 different emotions, like anger and fear. It takes them and it tries to map them on a kind of, it looks like a world map. This is a spectrum, if you will. You can go from pure anger to pure sadness, but you can kind of go between the two points as well. And it's pretty fun to move your mouse around and have a play with them. I think it's interesting because this game we've been playing is kind of silly, right? It's clearly a bit ambiguous what these sounds are. We can kind of get the ballpark, but really saying that this emotion that someone is expressing, this noise, this ha ha ha, he he he, or really means this, this, or this, it kind of depends on the person who you're asking, right?
All these people sound shady, but it's interesting because I also kind of pick up or realize my own biases.
So have you seen the movie Inside Out?
No, I've seen no movies.
In this film, it's a kid's film. Everyone's driving around with these people living inside their heads.
There's little people in there?
Yeah, and the people represent single emotions like fear or anger or sadness. That's not how people literally work, but it's kind of a simplified model of what many emotion scientists do actually think. And this isn't just a kind of quaint intellectual exercise. Today, we're going to be looking at a particular story, a particular scientific theory, which has kind of shaped a lot of the second half of the 20th century. It's a theory about how humans experience and express emotions.
Welcome back to This Will Change Your Mind, the show where we unpack how other people changed your mind.
I'm Chiquita Pascal.
And I'm Ian Steadman.
I am a doctor, I guess, Richard Firth Godby here, and I'm part of the Centre for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London.
So I was wondering, could I ask you to start by telling us what an emotion is?
No.
Let's start all the way at the beginning.
You can go back to Aristotle. Aristotle categorized emotions in a very different way to how we'd understand them now. In the early modern period, the beginnings of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, as some people call it, there were lots of people talking about emotions then. There are books categorizing emotions, well, categorizing passions, as they would have called them. So there was that. But in the world of sciences, really, you're looking at your anthropologists, people like Margaret Mead, who in the 20s went to American Samoa, to an island I can't pronounce. I think it's Tau, T-A-U. And she was trying to find out about emotions. And she believed that people on that island didn't really experience emotions in the same way they did in the West, that they didn't have these sort of what you might call moral emotions, and disgust and rage and anxiety and that sort of thing. So she thought, no, they were culturally based. And that, before the 60s, was what emotion research was. It was that sort of thing. Now, in the 60s, it became a bit more interesting, scientific-wise. Sylvan Tompkins first started to think, are these evolved? He got massively into Charles Darwin, read Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, thought, that's absolutely right, that's wonderful. And he started to come up with ideas about how emotions might be evolved, how we might find out what emotions are evolved and how we might understand them. And then he met the granddaddy of emotion science, Paul Ekman. Paul Ekman worked with Sylvan Tompkins, and they worked together to go around various countries, America, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, Japan, I think France, and a few others. And they asked people simple questions like, which of these faces would you pull if somebody jumped out at you, or something like that. And then they decided, from all this data of people pointing at faces, that there were six emotions. And kind of that's where it began.
So just six emotions?
Six basic emotions. There were many more, but they call them compound emotions. There were six we all had, they thought. The six they came up with were happiness, anger, sadness, disgust, surprise, and fear. Basic emotions. Happiness, anger, sadness, disgust, surprise, and fear.
It starts out with kind of innate, moving towards a culturally relativistic framework with Margaret Mead, and then it moves back to Paul Ekman going, nope, there's six. They're fundamental.
And they all didn't think that Mead was right. And so they tested it. And they first of all tested it, and then they thought to themselves, hang on, these cultures that we've looked at, they've all got access to Western media, they all know about each other, there can be cross-pollination here. How do we prove this? And so, a quite famous, growingly infamous experiment was done, where they went to Papua New Guinea, the Southeast Islands, into the Okapa Valley, and they met the Fori people. Now, the Fori people were supposedly never really seen by the West very often. There'd been a couple of missionaries there, and that's about it. The only way to get through to them was a very, very dodgy track, and most jeeps could only get halfway down, then you had to walk, you know. So they were great. They were a blank canvas. Let's do this experiment with them. Let's see what happens. And so Ekman and Friesen, who went on their wonderful journey to see the Fori people, took the same six facial expressions and got translators who they had trained quite vigorously to try and make sure they were asking exactly the same little short statements. And then they got themselves, they tried to find people who had definitely never seen the West before, and they found about 189 adults and 130, 140 children, something like that. And they tested them in exactly the same way, and lo and behold, got exactly the same faces. So that was it. They'd proven it, they thought. They definitely, that was it, they nailed it. There were six basic emotions, case closed, that was it.
Well, this seems kind of tricky just because of all the relativism involved. And I guess there are all these sorts of frameworks that the researchers wouldn't have understood about culture or and how it's kind of tied to emotions at the time when they were doing the studies. How did that affect our understanding of those results in retrospect?
There's been a lot of research done recently that has overturned the research. For a start, there are problems with Ekman and Friesen's study. So, firstly, the Fori people did know Westerners. Westerners had been there fairly often before they got there. So how honest the Fori people were all being paid, by the way, were when they said, no, I have no idea what's going on in the West. We don't know. Another problem is that the translators seem to have translated things into things that would cause people to pick those facial expressions, not necessarily the same sentences. It was, that's one of the big questions. How can they have translators if nobody's been there before? But also another problem is the facial of the photos. If you look them up, just put Ekman emotion faces and you'll see them. They'll appear in Google. They're really exaggerated. So when you run the same experiment, as has been done, with normal faces, pulling the faces you'd expect in the West, it doesn't work out so well. And if you also run this experiment with lots and lots and lots and lots of different facial expressions and ask different cultures to organise them themselves into groups of emotions, it's different again. We need to think more about the contexts of emotions. We need to think more about emotions than just faces, you know.
Have there been any non-Western or non-white research studies led where sort of a Western idea or conception of the emotional framework wasn't at the center of it?
There is a problem that the Ekman paper does still appear in everything you read. There's a couple of papers that have been done that are quite interesting by some Chinese researchers, but still you read them and the introduction starts talking about Ekman and Friesen.
This was 1971, and has there been... presumably Ekman didn't just do this one study.
Yeah, he did other studies. Mostly he went into something called micro-expressions. And the idea is that if you, even if you try and suppress an emotion, you will have a tiny little expression just around the eyes or somewhere, and you can't stop that. That's completely evolved. It's to be noted that Ekman himself doesn't believe there are 6 basic emotions anymore. The number he believes there are, still believes there are basic emotions, but the number varies over time.
Huh.
Kind of refines it. I think he's on 12 at the moment. It depends whether you include this one he has called neutral, which I still can't work out what that is.
Just neutral as an emotion.
Yeah, you see it in scientific papers all the time. We're studying emotions, happiness, sadness, and neutral. Is that asleep? What? I don't know.
That's very strange. So maybe now's a good time to ask, what have been the wider consequences of this theory being so long-lasting? How has it seeped out into the rest of culture?
It's still being used to this day to manipulate and upset us. There are advertising companies and marketing companies that use this kind of science all the time. There are some really sinister, interesting, sinister, however you want to take it, things out there that want to track your face while you're watching Facebook or looking at adverts and then fine-tune the advertising based on the emotions you had. There's airports. One thing Paul Ekman did is he ran a training program for the TSA over in America called SPOT, the Screening Passengers by Observation Techniques training program, and trained human beings to spot micro-expressions in people in the airport so they could pull them over because they thought they were going to do something dodgy. And it was catastrophic failure.
What kinds of waves were they feeling? Were they just like wildly off or misinterpreting things? Or
you can't read people's micro-expressions. If you could, if facial expressions gave away emotions, the same for all cultures, then if that were true, you still couldn't see micro-expressions because the whole point of a micro-expression is it takes a few milliseconds. So a human can't see that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Philly, and we have a permanent scowl on our face. That's just what you don't smile, you know? So what happened after that? Is there a silver lining?
The silver lining is these things don't work. They keep trying them, and they keep not working. Firstly, how you express emotions is contingent upon your upbringing and your culture. One example from my research is that before about 1735, before Johnson's dictionary, really, there wasn't really such a thing as disgust. There were all these other things, aversion and eschewment and avoidance and lots of different things that all coalesced into, hey, let's take that thing we do when we eat something that's horrible and let's make it this moral emotion. Darwin and then Ekman say it's a basic emotion that all creatures have. I think probably all mammals don't eat things that could poison them. You know, that's not the same as being disgusted by a murderer. And that's the problem, that difference between an internal state and an external expression. One of my fears is that we're being squashed into this idea that there are 6 basic emotions and all this technology is pushing everybody into them, which of course will then reinforce the idea that they exist, when actually it's because everybody's had to behave in a certain way and pull certain facial expressions to not get pulled over in an airport and, let's just say, searched.
So it's kind of like, remember in the late 90s when you had search engines like Ask Jeeves, where we would ask them like actual questions, and then with other search engines like Google, which were just like, what date American Revolution? Like, you just type the thing. And the later version won because we just learned to talk to the machines like machines understood. Is that essentially what you're saying here could happen with emotions as well?
I think so, yeah. I think we could see them all becoming, the human race becoming homogenized with the same set of emotions and emotion responses as we become more global and more international. You know, it's just... See, I like different emotions in different
countries. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
I was in Tunisia once and there were two people playing chess and they actually started shouting at each other and screaming. And I asked my mum, who lived there for years, I said, what's that about? She's always just saying it was a great game. Okay, fine, you know. Brilliant, what a great move that was. Didn't see it coming. Do you want a drink? Was what they were actually saying. They were about to hit each other.
So, like, what can we do to stop this? I mean, you said already, like, these things, these systems, these technologies that use this emotional six emotion theory don't work, but people seem to be pretty intent on trying to make them. So what can we do?
Well, there is some good news.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I'm ready for that.
So there are starting to be some companies out there that are starting to think a bit more about other theories of emotion.
That's interesting and potentially reassuring, but it worries me that you have this framework that seems very problematic, that's lasted this long and is still being used to design products and services to this day. So I think we need to speak to someone at this point who's doing that to find out exactly what they're thinking about all this.
I'm Rana El-Kalyoubi, co-founder and CEO of Affectiva. So the way we do it is we collect a ton of data. So far, we have over 4 billion facial frames of people emoting as they go about their daily activities, with their permission, of course. We're an MIT Media Lab spin-out. We build technology that can read and understand human emotions, cognitive states, and then make that available to devices and our technologies and digital experiences in a way that improves our connection with technology and thereby our connection with each other as humans as well.
So that's a huge data set. Sorry, what was that number again? Something 4 billion, did you say?
4 billion facial frames. Yeah, it's a combination of people watching content online, driving their cars around during their daily commutes, and it's a very global data set. So we have data from about 87 countries around the world. So these are different ways where you can get at this ground truth of, okay, what exactly are you feeling? We're very interested in codifying what's happening on the face because that's a signal, right? And then, of course, we are interested in mapping what's happening on the face to your internal state of mind, right? Or state of heart or whatever. The very first product we brought to market was in advertising testing. So right now we work with 25% of the Fortune Global 500 companies to test their ads worldwide, where they can see exactly how people responded to different product categories or around the world, right? Like, so if you test the same shampoo ad in the US versus Brazil versus China, how do people respond?
Are you creating like a, not a six basic emotions database, for example, but maybe a 10, a 20, a 50, a 1,000 different emotional categories?
Yeah.
How finessed is your quantification?
So right now, you know, our data, you know, goes through the annotation team, and the annotation team annotated for these underlying facial expression building blocks, but they also annotate for expressions of the six basic emotions, as well as these other states like cognitive overload, drowsiness. We have at least three different levels of drowsiness that we codify for. And basically the way this works, you say you want to train the computer to recognize a smirk, right? Which is an asymmetric mouth movement, often indicating a negative emotion, like you're skeptical or you're doubtful. And so the way we do this is we will find or curate from our data hundreds of thousands of examples of people smirking, and then hundreds of thousands of examples of people not smirking. And the more diverse these people are, the better the algorithm's going to be. We feed that into our deep learning networks, and then we test it. So we then feeded examples of smirks that it's never seen, and we quantify the accuracy. And often if it's less than 90% accurate, we iterate, we keep training and retraining the model until it gets there.
You start from the premise there of like, these are smirks and these are not smirks with these pictures. What about when the definition of a smirk is different from one part of the world to the other?
So our position is that facial expressions are by and large universal. However, there are these cultural norms or display rules, and actually Ekman has published a lot about this. You know, I'm originally from the Middle East, I'm Egyptian, and people are not always forthcoming with how they feel, especially if it's a negative emotion. And we've certainly seen that around other areas in the world. The very first type of work we did where people were responding to ads, they were less comfortable sharing how they truly or expressing how they truly feel about an ad, especially in the presence of strangers. So our job was to really make it comfortable for people to authentically share how they're feeling.
Have you ever come across emotions that are defined specifically by a certain culture or country or nation or language, but don't really have analogs outside of that?
We haven't yet. I imagine we will as the taxonomy of emotions we're capturing becomes more and more complex. I will say that I remember a few years ago, we were visiting one of the top automotive manufacturers in Japan, and we were posing some of the use cases. So we talked about, you know, distracted driving and drowsy driving, and we talked about road rage. And I, you know, the Japanese executives in the room basically said, oh, no, we don't ever talk about road rage. That's just not accepted in our culture. And so that really made me think, you're absolutely right. There are some emotions that are more just socially acceptable, or could the nuance of the emotions could differ from one culture to the other. But it's early days for the technology.
So this is this would be the car would detect when you had road rage.
Correct.
And what would happen then?
It's a driver monitoring system. So you could imagine a camera that's kind of in the steering wheel column or maybe the rear view mirror of your car. It can flag if you are distracted. I mean, we see a lot of example of people on their phones texting, or if you're extremely tired, or you're angry, you're on a call and you're visibly angry, or you're angry at some other driver. The question is, how does the car then respond? So, you know, some vehicles, if it's semi-autonomous, maybe the vehicle says, I'm going to take control and drive this car. It can give you an alert. It can engage if you're, for example, if you're super tired, it can engage with the conversational interface in the vehicle, and like a Siri or an Amazon Alexa can start chatting with you to keep you awake. There's all sorts of possibilities.
Hmm. Well, are there some other practical examples like that that you could talk about of where this technology is being applied?
We have partners in the mental health space that are exploring how to use our technology to, for example, help individuals on the autism spectrum.
Ah, so it's kind of translating emotions.
I actually like that. I like how you said that, because I do think we are in the business of translating emotions. That's what we're doing. Whether we're translating it in between human and machine or human to human, at the end of the day, we're trying to bridge this gap and translate these emotion signals that right now just disappear in cyberspace.
But is there anything you're worried about that could go wrong with any of this? Algorithms can replicate the biases or assumptions of those who use or create them and the information mm-hmm. that's fed into mm-hmm. them. And this stuff can be really unpredictable. When you're talking about putting this into a mental health context, what kind of red flags are you looking for?
So I'll start with the ethical development. My biggest concern around this technology is accidentally building bias in these algorithms or in the data. So, you know, there's been a number of news articles around how facial recognition technology discriminates against people of color, especially women of color. And so what we do, you know, to mitigate this kind of bias, you have to be very thoughtful about the data you're collecting, how you're sampling the data. There needs to be an equal representation of gender, ethnic groups, age ranges, you know, people wearing glasses or people with facial beards or wearing the hijab. And then on the deployment side, one of our core values as a company is we kind of understand that emotions are so personal, right? They're perhaps the most personal data you have or own. we absolutely have to require consent and opt in, explicit consent and opt in, not even opt out, which meant that there were some industries we decided to stay away from, like security and surveillance and lie detection, even though we are routinely asked to apply the technology in these industries, and it's probably very lucrative.
This kind of goes back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier, back to Paul Ekman. Because I wanted to ask about stuff like the SPOT program, which is one of these situations where this kind of science seems to be, well, from my perspective, maliciously applied. So do you think it's possible ever to apply this science in a way? You're always going to have safeguards.
We can't forget that humans are very biased, right? So I'll give you one example, you know, one use case of our technology. We are partnered with a company called HireVue. They are in the recruiting business. So instead of sending a Word document or a Word resume, you send a short video of yourself talking about what you're passionate about, your prior experiences. But of course, video is very time consuming to watch. So it's not realistic to have an HR professional watch all of this video content. And so they use our technology. The algorithm takes a first look at the candidates. And what is fascinating is this algorithm is gender and ethnic blind. You know, it's looking at your nonverbal communication. Whereas humans are very, very biased when it comes to hiring. HireVue partnered with Unilever and they did a global study using this technology, and they found that kind of it increased the diversity of the population that got hired by 16%.
And this actually segues quite nicely into something that came up in talking to Richard Firth Godby here, who's a historian of emotion science. He was wary about the possibility that by embedding emotion recognition technology into devices or services or products in any way, you kind of codify what emotions are at this point in history. And it's going to be, in a way, teaching people to write for the algorithm rather than the algorithm reflecting what the people think and feel. It's like, do you think that that's a legitimate worry?
I don't know. I think, well, the way you train these algorithms is it's a combination of both the machine learning scientists or the people who are codifying these algorithms, but also the data, right? So I would think the data would evolve over time to reflect how society communicates. Yeah, it's a good question, though. I'm not sure.
It gets very philosophical, I know.
I'm super excited because I think we're in the midst of a human-machine interface transformation where machines are becoming more conversational, more perceptual, and will have more EQ and empathy. And so that will mean that we, you know, as humans, we've always communicated with machines on their terms, using their language. And finally, now machines are going to be able to communicate with us just the way we communicate with one another. Today, the gold standard in how we measure and quantify mental health conditions is using a survey. And it's very, very subjective, unreliable data. But with emotion AI, we have an opportunity to bring a lot of objectivity. We have an opportunity to track that data longitudinally. So I just think there's huge opportunity around mental health. It's a very untapped area with a lot of potential to do good.
I got to be honest, I'm still wary.
So how about you? Are you reassured?
To be honest, not completely, no. I think it's promising. I mean, I see the optimistic side of it, and I see, you know, I'm really, I would say, relieved to know that companies like Affectiva that are working within this space are trying to do so from an ethical standpoint. But I think over time, you know, interests can change, values of a company can change, leadership of a company can change, so many things.
There are also going to be companies out there that aren't as scrupulous. That's the thing that worries me.
Yeah, I'm tentatively on edge, but cautiously optimistic.
Tentatively on edge. Yeah. It feels difficult to escape in a way.
Yeah.
In the way that surveillance in general, online and in real life, has been harder and harder to escape.
Even with social media too, like all the permissions and things that we give out, like I think there is a kind of a mass denial or just like a mass self-denial. We kind of have to maybe not necessarily lie to ourselves, but be willfully ignorant or in making this choice of convenience have to accept that we no longer live in an age where privacy exists the way that it has in the past.
Yeah. And it's also, I guess we had to adapt to this idea that, like, when it comes to losing privacy, when it comes to surveillance at least, and when it comes to a lot of the stuff that's being talked about here, when it comes to like a car that scans your face and figures out if you've got road rage and takes control, for example.
Yeah, nope, I got resting bitch face. That's not, how's that going to work out for me?
But it's like there's an implicit demand of trust there. Like, you know, when there's a CCTV camera that's pointing down a street, it's recording stuff, but you understand that that's going to be someone watching that footage and making a decision based on being a human about what the stuff they see is. This is a scientific theory that is kind of obtuse. If I just read a press release that says a car is going to read my emotions, I assume that the science that that's based on is going to be pretty sound.
Well, that's the thing. Like, all of our technology, like the foundations of it, were formed by humans. So I guess what it leaves me wondering is, like, how much do we actually program our biases into our machines?
Yeah, because machines are as biased as the people who make them.
Right.
And also, I just can't get away from the fact that when we spoke to Richard, he was talking about how emotions didn't used to exist.
I know. That was wild. I was like, what?
So if how can you do, it's, if it's just this case of like a shifting mutable definition for something, how can we really claim to be able to detect it and analyze it so scientifically? Like, emotions might not even exist in a way that makes sense to apply a taxonomy to. It might be something else that we're measuring.
It seems to me that a lot of these emotions or how we codify emotions is based on our cultural value system. There are probably cultural value systems that we can't understand that maybe predate language or we don't have a record of. You know, when I think about the future, like maybe Americans will evolve out of road rage somehow.
So the takeaway here, it seems to be that if you see someone claiming that they have a machine that can read your emotions, be skeptical and ask them about their taxonomy. The most important thing.
And roll credits. Okay.
You've been listening to This Will Change Your Mind, part of the Diffusion Network. Our theme song is Document Swell by Rainforest Station, while our outro track and other music is from the album The Illusion Is Worth Fighting For by King's Tux. Our producer is Sarah Miles, and you can find out more about us and the show on our website, thiswillchangeyourmind.com. Including links to some of the things we talked about in the episode, like that map of emotions from the start of the show. If you haven't subscribed yet, we're available anywhere there are podcasts, including iTunes, and it would be so helpful if you wanted to leave us a review if you enjoyed the show. In the next episode, we're going to head back in time to 2009 and examine what happened when a group of climate scientists had thousands of their emails hacked, then dumped on the web, and how those emails were taken out of context to try and make us all doubt whether the Earth is getting warmer or not. See you then.